tonight on Arena. We speak to the winner of this year's Women's Prize for Fiction, and Arcadian Hounds and Inside Out are the movies up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In films tonight, we have the sequel to Disney Pixar's animated hit Inside Out. The new one's called Inside Out 2. It brings out the long-awaited sequel nearly a decade later. Brand new emotions to add to the mix here, with the voices of the bears Ayo Edebiri as Envy and Maya Hawke as Anxiety. Film number 2 brings us scary scenes in Wicklow as Nicolas Cage follows up his work with Lurkin Finnegan on The Surfer with another feature with an Irish connection, an apocalyptic horror called Arcadian. Film features Cage alongside Stranger Things stars Jaden Martell and a return to the big screen for Maxwell Jenkins. And to round things off, the directorial debut of one Kamal Larraq, film called Hounds, gritty thriller set over one long dark night in the suburbs of the Moroccan city of Casablanca. Hounds won the jury prize for Un Certain Regard, that part of the programme, at the Cannes Festival in 2023. Joined by our film reviewers this evening, Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark. Let us start with Inside Out 2, where we're returning to the inner workings of the head and mind of one Riley Anderson, but she is now a teenager. Headquarters are going under, undergoing demolition, and there'll be some new emotions to join in with the old ones. Yes, joy, sadness, fear, anger and disgust are still there, but they're being joined by fear and anxiety. With me to talk about the films this evening, as I said, are our two reviewers, Donald Clark and Serena Bellissimo. Let us talk about Inside Out 1, first of all, mm-hmm. Donald. Do we need to know anything about Riley Anderson, the child, to get stuck into Riley Anderson, the teenager's exploits in Inside Out 2?
I don't think so, no. They're quite good at setting up the mechanics of their world in Pixar. And I think Pete Docter, the head bods of Pixar, has always been very clear about that. One of the rules you have is you make sure everyone understands the universe you're in the first 5 or 10 minutes. You will obviously understand it if you've seen Inside Out 2, which worked back to quite an old kind of conceit. You may remember from the Numbskulls, and was it the Beano, was that Dandy, back when you and I were little whippersnappers, in which all the various components of a psyche were all working away inside someone's brain. Herman's Head did it then, that on TV a few decades ago. Inside Out, I think, to be fair to him, probably perfected it. I mean, if there was a problem with that film, it may have been the fact that it worked that very American notion that everything can be reduced to a system or a pattern, that if you have the right staff, you can somehow make order out of everything, even the convoluted chaos within human psyche. This one is kind of about that system breaking down. It's not a bad idea, and what else would more likely to have that break down than puberty?
And the teenager aspect of things, I suppose, in that case, Serena, the fact that we have all of the insides of a teenager's head being exposed to us in this fashion, and that there's going to be mayhem and chaos between all of the emotions as a result, is it a little bit of an easy take on teenage? Is it dismissive of teenage angst?
It's not, which I loved. I love that it explored that, you know what, things do start to change when you become a teenager. I just think that I need to say from the start, because when I tell people how I feel about this, they're like, oh, so you didn't like it. No, I enjoyed it. But it's really hard when you watch something and the original was so good. And like, we only watched the original back on Saturday night because my 8-year-old hadn't seen it and he was so looking forward to seeing the sequel. So we watched it back and I went, wow, even, you know, the original was 2015, and even after all these years and we know what's going to happen, it's still amazing and it packs an emotional punch. Inside Out 2, if you're looking for that same emotional punch that you got in Inside Out, I don't think you're going to get it. Like, I was on the verge of maybe feeling something towards the end, but I wasn't feeling it all throughout. Right. It seems to be more complex.
Yeah, I should say that in Inside Out 1, it's called the Bing Bong moment. If you haven't seen the film, you won't know what we're talking about. If you have seen the film, you will, and you'll know why the Bing Bong moment is a big moment of emotion. However, let us go to a clip from Inside Out 2. And here we're getting four new emotions into the mix. The first voice that you're going to hear is Anxiety, played by Maya Hawke. Ayo Edebiri as Envy, audibly grimacing. Embarrassment is a very is in here as well as a very aloof Ennui. You'll never guess what nationality Ennui is going to give us in the accent. Let's have a listen.
I'm Anxiety. I'm one of Riley's new emotions, and we are just super jazzed to be here. Where can I put my stuff?
What do you mean, we?
Oh, I wish I was as tall as all of you.
Who the heck are you?
I'm Envy.
Oh, look at your hair.
Oh, yeah, not happening.
Okay, who's this guy?
What's your name, big fella?
That's embarrassment. He's not really big on eye contact or, like, good talking, but he's a really sweet guy.
Well, welcome to headquarters, embarrassment. Oh, we're doing a fit. No. Oh, nope. Going high. Oh, you got a real sweaty palm there, buddy.
What emotion was that?
That's ennui.
On what?
Ennui. It's what you would call the boredom.
Well, come on up here. Ennui. Am I saying right? And why? No. Oh, nicknames. I'm going to call you Wee Wee.
No.
Oh, dear. Well, there we had a variety of emotions from Inside Out 2. Anxiety, Maya Hawke. Ayo Edebiri's Envy. Don't know who embarrassment was there. And Ennui played very laconically, of course, by Adele Exarchopoulos. I'm never quite sure how to say that.
I think I like the film more than Serena, but I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, I give it an extra star for Adele Exarchopoulos in this. So yes. I just think it's absolutely fantastic. And it was an actress I like anyway, but there's probably no other French actress around now of her generation who's better at that thing, that kind of the black polo neck and the shrug, which indicates that degree of lack of interest that only the French can manage. Now, that was genuinely very funny, and I kind of snorted to myself every time she appeared, and I can't think of, another French actress of her generation to do it.
We would probably be quite happy to see an Irish person doing a little bit of Irishness in this or something like this.
Yeah,
and
it's a funny one.
The French person doing it kind of takes the edge off.
I was wondering about that. Is this something that the French would take offence to, this notion that you would represent boredom by essentially a caricature of the entire of French femaleness would be what you would use to represent boredom. I think probably not. I think they're probably quite proud of their reputation.
Yeah. Or they would not care.
Exactly.
They wouldn't care.
My 8-year-old wanted to know. He was like, okay, so here in the English film, they say ennui is boredom. What do they do in French? Do they go ennui is ennui?
I wonder how that will play. I
mean, is she called boredom and then they say ennui?
I'm sure they'll say ennui, but I wonder how they'll play that in terms of the voice work and that.
That's a very interesting question from your 8-year-old.
Have to look into that.
So given that you have said that it didn't pack the same emotional punch, is there a good narrative drive through Inside Out 2?
It's still really good. So Riley's just literally turned into a teenager. I think for me, what I wish it had more of, I love Riley inside her family unit as well as outside of the family unit, right? So in this, you saw only mere glimpses of her family unit and you saw more about her friendship group. So it was more...
But what I thought was moving about it was that, funny, was it just generalised notion that as you move into a certain stage in life, life just gets much more difficult and frankly more miserable. I think there's a genuine... It's interesting that you have this notion that these new emotions are now going to rule your life, and possibly not just your adolescent life, possibly the rest of your life. You're going to be ruled by jealousy and boredom and all these awful things that come in with regard to psychological defects.
Anxiety, does that come in?
And anxiety, of course.
I'm sure it does. Well.
But it's kind of worse than that. There's a point... They go off on a journey, which is again pretty amusing. The old emotions are flung out of the out of headquarters and end up on the classic, you know, Joseph Campbell style journey back to order. And at some point in their joy, a voice by Amy Poehler says something to the effect of like, well, maybe it's just what happens when you're an adult. You just feel less joy, and God, what a depressing notion. And The film, obviously, I should say, in case people think, God, I can't take my child to this. This sounds like something from a Russian novel. The less you did, I should assure people, obviously, by the end, it ends up in a happier place. But it never quite shaped that notion. They never quite shaped the notion that the message of the film is that being older is a miserable business, miserable, anxious bitter business. They never quite shake that. I quite like that. I quite like that they're brave enough to do that.
But a big bong message at the end. Just as you give us your final judgment on the film itself, it sounds as if you both had a good time at it.
Yeah.
But more importantly, your 8-year-old was there, and did you have your second child as
well? So I took my 8-year-old and my 13-year-old. I'll start with the 13-year-old. She said she gave it 4 stars, which is huge for a 13-year-old. She said it's a really good movie, but what I really loved is she says teens will really feel it. Right?
Teens would really feel it.
She's just turned 13.
So it's kind of possibly it's more aimed at that
but
kind of age.
My son has been to quite a few films this year, and they've gone close to the 5 stars.
Right.
This is the first one to get 5 stars from the 8-year-old. He said it was really good. He loved all of the new motions and the new adventures. And this is like the icing on the cake. He'd tell all his friends to go watch it.
All right. And what are you saying?
Do you know, I give it 3.5 out of 5, only because it has the first one to compare. It just never reached the heights of the initial one. But if you were to take it as a standalone, I'd maybe give it a 4. But comparing it to the first, 3.5.
And what are you saying overall, Donald?
I give it a 4. I mean, I think Pixar have been up and down in recent years. Mm. I mean, and I think this is probably back on the up curve, I think, again. So I would happily give it 4. Though I will say again, if it weren't for Adele, it might be 3.5. I like that joke so much that I can't not
you
give it 4.
You didn't get bored of it, for sure. Okay. 3.5 and 4, respectively, then, for Inside Out 2. Let's move on to film number 2. Nicolas Cage is on the tip of our tongues again here. We have cast our minds back to our report from Cannes. Tara Brady deliberating on who could win the Palme d'Or. Nicolas Cage fronted another film there, The Irish Contingent, The Surfer, directed by Lorcan Finnegan. We're in Ireland again, filmed in locations across County Wicklow. Arcadian is a post-apocalyptic thriller which follows Paul, this is the character played by Cage, and his 2 sons, Thomas and Joseph, who live amongst serene surroundings by day but face the horrors that come with unrelenting attacks from a mysterious evil by night. You know, how many Irish films have I started out with post-apocalyptic thriller? We seem to be in a kind of a post-apocalyptic horror moment with Irish film in some ways, Donald.
We have the landscape for it, I think, don't we? That you wouldn't need to go to, shall we say, the south of France if this was the kind of atmosphere you wanted to
Not
convey.
Gothic enough,
It's an odd one, this. I mean, on paper, I mean, it reads like one of those films Roger Corman used to make in response to any mainstream horror success. So if there was a Scream, you'd make a Shriek. If there was a Nightmare on Elm Street, you'd make a Bad Dream on Sycamore Avenue, whatever it might be. And in this case, the model seems to be A Quiet Place. It's a family survives an apocalypse that has something to do with invasion by big lizard things. They seek to negotiate life in some sinister corner of, as you say, the Irish countryside. It's actually a bit better than that suggests. I mean, it has its rampaging flaws, but it's a reasonably classy, independent production, I think. Cage, who, as you say, was recently in Premier of The Surfer at Cannes, is on robust, relatively restrained form by his standards as father of these 2 boys. I mean, mind you, he vanishes to a sickbed after the first 45 minutes. He's barely in it for the second half of the film. Wow. But for those 45 minutes, I think he's pretty good. There are peculiar things about it, though, not least the fact that where are we is an interesting point, because it has that feel of sort of folk apocalypse as you've got in films like, for example, the underrated Kevin MacDonald film How I Live Now with Saoirse Ronan from a few years back, which I thought was great. Except those things are very kind of big on the English or Irish countryside. To us, it seems blatantly obvious that it's set in Ireland,
but
shot in Ireland. Yeah. Could be Wales.
Could be anywhere,
Thereabouts. But it appears to be set in the United States, which I can never quite believe in the film. I mean, it could be the Pacific Northwest, possibly.
Yes, I suppose.
But I think that's maybe our flaw rather than the films. Yes. We are so familiar with the countryside.
This is
obviously Ireland. Why are you telling me it's not Ireland?
you're already, I see a grimace on your face, Serena, as you're about to talk about this. But let's give the basic setup here. Donald has given us the sense that it is Nicolas Cage is the dad. He has 2 sons.
Yeah, see, I can't even give you the setup because I was watching it going, don't exactly know, like, what is exactly happening. I know that Nicolas Cage has twin sons. Mm-hmm. They're in danger. I'm not quite sure why they are in danger. I'm not quite sure why these monsters exist. I'm not connecting with anybody. And then these monsters only come out at nighttime. What's happened is there's his family that lives on a secluded farm, and then one of his twin sons has befriended another family. And I don't know how or why that happened. He seemed to go out maybe to make money, but I don't know why they need money because they're living on the land. I just feel like, don't get me wrong, again, I went into this one. I don't know what it is about Nicolas Cage, but if he's in something, I'm going to give it a go just because it is Nicolas Cage.
He always does his best. Yeah.
And he does. He does do his best. But for me, it just, there was something missing here because I just wasn't connecting. And look,
they try and make a virtue of that confusion, don't they? And they have a conversation where they speculate as to what may have happened, which communicates to us that they don't really know what's happened.
But as a result, like, I felt like, you know, I don't know what the first 5 minutes were about when we saw these twin babies and then all of a sudden they were teenagers. Mm. And then I just felt I needed a little bit more at the start to connect with the family because there was never peril.
My problem was more with the creatures, and it feels kind of mean to say that because as only kind of, you know, a decade or so ago, getting creatures this good on this budget would have been inconceivable. Yeah. But now we're quite used to the fact that you can, on a relatively limited budget, you can produce, I presume they're digitally created, you can produce digital creatures on this scale. But, I mean, they come across as rather kind of clumsy chimera drawn from several different movies, a bit of Alien, there's a bit of A Quiet Place there, though I may be accidental. The clacking thing they do, I guess, is kind of creepy. But you need to find some defining characteristic when you're designing.
But the only thing
they have here is this notion that they could form themselves into rings and become a kind of menacing wheel, which is not very frightening.
Yeah,
frightening,
I suppose. No. If you don't have something amazing, then don't show it because it'll be way more scary if you don't see it.
That's what they always say, that rule is a good rule, I think.
Let's have a listen to Nicolas Cage's Paul. Jaden Martell, Joseph is the twin that he's playing. The other guy, Thomas, goes missing. Is that it?
Or I can't remember.
One of the twins goes missing. Yeah. And this is the other one who's at home when Nicolas Cage as Paul pulls up on his motorbike, rather disturbed, it has to be said.
Where's your brother?
He's not here?
No, where is he?
I don't know. He said he was going to go to the Rose Farm and said to meet him before sunset. He wasn't there.
You'll lock down the house on your own tonight. I'll be back with your brother in the morning.
No, I'll come with you.
I need you to secure the house. You know what to do.
I'm sorry, Dad.
This isn't your fault. This is my fault. Keep watch this lot.
So there we had Nicolas Cage and Jaden Martell as father and son, respectively. The other son, the twin, is gone missing. I was saying as we were listening to that, Serena, Cage is relatively restrained there, but
in that bit. But then, you know, I'm not spoiling anything to say we do get to see a bit of warrior action Cage, and he relishes in those moments.
Yeah.
And again, because there was no connection for me, I didn't really care what happened to these characters.
But I suppose the ultimate thing with a horror is, and a thriller is, were there jump moments? Did you get the jump scares that are needed to kind of get any kind of enjoyment, if that's what the word is, out of a horror movie?
I'm a wuss. You know, I don't usually go near these films. I didn't get the jump scares that I needed, and maybe because it felt really dark. Sometimes I couldn't see what was going on because I think it was supposed to be poorly lit, but as a result, maybe I need new glasses. I don't know. But as a result, it felt like I couldn't see.
Too shadowy for you.
Yeah.
I suppose that's down to the direction then and the camera work here.
It's not badly made. I think it is pretty, pretty well made. It feels like it hasn't been thought through fully, is my feeling about it. And particularly, as I say, in regard to the creatures, which you just need to have some defining characteristic that sets them apart from all the other similar creatures that we, for example, you have the hearing thing in The Quiet Place, which is the film it resembles most. And they just don't have that thing.
Is it scary? Was it scary?
It's okay. Yeah, I mean, it has its moments of kind of siege. There are siege moments that are quite good, where it becomes a bit of assault in Precinct 13, or The Thing, and those moments are done quite well. But it's never sustained very long. I mean, the tension does tend to wander after any 5 minutes of top action.
And we mentioned Serena. We mentioned John. What's his first name? Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. Donald Cage.
Different fella, yeah. Might be mixing up me metaphors there, too, as it were. Jin Martell, Maxwell Jenkins, and Sadie Sovereil complete. It's kind of a basic quartet at the heart of the film. How are the other performances?
I think the acting's great. So yeah. I've got nothing against the performances. Mm. The performances are great. I think it's just that the story lacked something somehow. But look, if you are, do you know what I will say about this? 90 minutes. It came in at 90 minutes, and I give any film that comes in at 90 minutes an extra star just for that.
Well, it has that feeling themselves. of this sort of thing that is made for kind of a slightly pulpy audience is always at 90 minutes. I mean, they know not to extend these things 2 hours.
Okay.
Stars from you. Does.
Yeah. Stars from you, Serena.
It's not my type of film, so I'm going to give it. I'm going to give it three. Yeah.
A three. What do you think?
I think three.
Overall,
it's fine.
Donald?
You know, it's perfectly fine within its limited range. I think by all means, go and see it in the cinema. Support kind of Irish co-productions, but yes. It probably belongs in the streaming service.
All right. Okay. Let us move on.
On Shudder, I believe, and Shudder have it, which is the horror streaming service. So.
All right. Okay. So go there.
Probably where it belongs.
Let us go to film number three then. Hounds. This is a crime thriller written and directed by Kamal Lazrak. It's his directorial debut, set in the suburbs of the Moroccan city of Casablanca. Do we know much
debut
about
debut feature? I don't know much more beyond that. It was in A Certain Regard last year in Cannes and did very well. It got very well received there.
So what is the basic setup here? It's all over one long dark night.
It's a long dark night. There's a whole genre of films, isn't there? There are one long dark night films about last night that springs to mind. For one, but for my mind, it is a very neat little film that has a perfect setup, and I think that's a great thing to have. These two guys, a father and a son, are dispatched to bring back the owner of a dog that has killed a hoodlum's own dog.
And we're in Casablanca. We're in
Morocco. We're in Casablanca. They go, they pick up this guy, they put him in the boot, they drive him back and discover he's suffocated on the way back. They then have, it is sort of set up quite cleanly that you have, until daybreak essentially, you have the night to get rid of this body. So they're trying to get rid of a body on the streets of Casablanca, which is a very neat, effective scenario, which allows him to drive the film through, again, in a neat 95 minutes, I think, with great momentum. And it allows you to go to all kinds of places in the city, so you get quite a Dickensian sweep of ne'er-do-wells throughout the city as they wander around. You also get a kind of Dickensian degrees of humour at various points. So at one point, they make an arrangement with a fisherman to take him out into the sea and dump them. That doesn't work out. That ends up kind of in a blackly comic fashion. And so all that stuff is accommodated very well by, I say, this very neat high concept, which I admire very greatly, which would be nothing if you didn't have the kind of filmmaking you have here, particularly in terms of the camera work, which really gets at the gristle and grit of Casablanca while still making it seem like a very exciting place to be.
And obviously you have all the activity of Casablanca. Now, it is a long dark night. I don't know how busy the streets are, but essentially with this father and son, the son Ayub El Aid and the father Abdelatif Mastouri was a street vendor. Not a non-actor before this performance.
And apparently, so before this, Kamal had done a short film as well. And what he likes to do, he's from the Casablanca area as well. Mm. So it's really interesting when you get someone filming in their own backyard right? You get a different story. And he likes to take non-actors because he believes that they can really give the performance, that they're actually being true to themselves rather than someone putting on a performance. And apparently Ayub, he saw in a photo, they had the chats, then he disappeared. He tracked him down to his little village. And he was like, I don't know why you want me. I've never acted. Ayub then said, what about this guy I know, Abdelatif? And he was a street vendor. He'd been to Europe. He'd been a taekwondo champion. He'd been to prison. A lot of the people that they'd cast had been to prison. So it's like you're getting this raw emotion that you're not getting from actual actors. And there was a lot of improvisation. But they did say when the scene wasn't going the way it was meant to go, they did come in and go, let's go back to the script.
Right.
But
it's,
do you know, and a lot of people aren't going to compare this to this. Because I have to say, when I first watched, I was like, Donald, what are you making me watch? Because I'm not watching a film about, you know, because it starts with the dogs fighting. And I was like, I don't want to watch this.
Yeah.
But then it turns into this great father-son relationship and all these cultural moments as well. But it reminded me, and a lot of people won't say this, it reminded me of Little Miss Sunshine because it was all about the van that didn't work and trying to get them to where they needed to go.
I'm always in two minds about the non-actor thing. I have to be absolutely upfront because a good actor, it won't look like a performance. It will look like
a
character.
It requires great talent on the part of the director to carry that off. It's interesting that the last Ken Loach film, I felt, for example, half the non-actors were great and half of them weren't. And that's Ken Loach, who's been doing this for 60 years. Mm. So it's a hard thing to pull off. And I agree with Sreena. I think they've pulled it off extremely well here. And they, even though you're dealing to a certain extent with non-actors, they still get great. They still manage to do good character work here, particularly in terms of the relationship between father and
son. Yeah.
And you get this kind of fascinating dynamic that the father is the one who puts him gets him into this trouble. And yet he's the one who's suddenly getting all sentimental and religious about the body then. He insists that it go through the proper rites before burial. And the son's like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, we just suffocated this guy and we're now trying to get rid of the body. And he doesn't say this, but this is implicit in his attitude.
Yes.
And yet you're now being all kind of hoity-toity about giving the correct religious sacraments before we dump him into the ocean or whatever we're going to do, or set fire to him, whatever we're going to do with him. And I should also say, it has one of the grimmest last shots, which I'll say nothing, in the film. So be prepared for that fact that you're watching this film and you're uneasy. There's an extremely grim last shot.
Yeah, so this sounds like one that you both got something really strong from overall. What are you saying about it, Sreena, and your final judgment and stars?
I'm going to give it a 4, and I really hope Hollywood don't get their hands on this, because if they do, it's going to turn into a farcical romp. Yeah.
All right, okay. So see it now before it's destroyed by Hollywood. A 4, did you say?
I'll give this a 4.
All right, pretty solid 4. And what are you saying, Donald?
Oh, 4, definitely. I look forward very much to what he does next. It's an incredibly promising debut.
All right, that is Hounds. It's in cinemas from Friday, June the 14th. That's tomorrow, isn't it? Yes. Vertigo, same thing, out tomorrow. And indeed, Disney Pixar's Inside Out 2. Sreena Bellissimo and Donald Clark are two reviewers on this Thursday evening. Donegal guitarist and singer Muireann Bradley rose to fame after her stunning performance on Jules Holland's annual Hootenanny New Year's Eve of last year. 17-year-old Ballybuffet native, known for her unique take on early blues masters, released her debut album, I Kept These Old Blues. She released it last December. People like Reverend Gary Davis, Robert Johnson are the influencers here. Muireann began playing guitar at the age of 9, inspired by her dad, and her viral YouTube performance of Blind Blake's Police Dog Blues caught the attention of an American record company, leading to her first album recording. And I'm delighted that Muireann and her guitar are sitting opposite me in studio this evening. I'm going to start with a song, and Muireann is going to sing and play Delia for us.
Delia was a gambling girl. Delia was a rabbit eye garage. Double seated head. Carry Delia down to the graveyard and she ain't never coming back. All the friends I've had are gone. Delia, oh, how can it be? You always wanted everyone, but you never had time for me. All the friends I've ever had are gone.
The Reverend Gary Jenkins, our Gary Davies song, Delia, sung for us this evening live on Arena by Muireann Bradley. And yes, Muireann Bradley, just one guitar. That's all that you heard there, despite the fact that it sounds like an orchestra of guitars to me. Muireann, when did that style of playing, when did you start that? How young were you when you kind of picked up the guitar and thought, I like the sound of that, I'll give it a go?
I was nine when I got my first guitar for my ninth birthday, and that's when my dad started teaching me.
And your dad played guitar himself?
Yeah, he plays guitar himself, yeah.
Same kind of style?
Yeah, exact same, yeah.
So you essentially, was he your teacher in those areas?
Yeah, he was. He's still my teacher, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, he still teaches me.
I'm sure he teaches you to a certain extent, but there must be an awful lot of, and must have been, an awful lot of listening involved in the learning of these tunes as well.
Yeah, you really need to like listen to them a lot to kind of get the feel of, and the groove. There's a lot of groove involved in it to get the feel that they would have got.
And when you talk about the groove there, is it the kind of the rhythm of it, or what?
It's
do you
the
mean?
Rhythm kind of. It's the rhythm. Like if you use, like, you know, a lot of people would use like a metronome. If you use that,
yes,
playing blues music, you just wouldn't get the right feel. It's just, you know,
it needs a kind of a looseness,
yeah,
about it.
Need looseness and a, yeah.
I was saying to you earlier on, and I was still amazed looking at it, you playing just now in front of me. I was watching the YouTube the Police Dog Blues earlier on. I was watching that on YouTube, which was the big viral hit for you, and it's only your thumb and two fingers of the fingers that you're plucking with. I presumed, oh, this finger picking, all the fingers must be flying around like mad to get that amount of sound. But it is only the thumb and two fingers.
Yeah, it's most players would only use a thumb and two fingers. So, yeah, some would even use a thumb and one finger. So,
And have you ever attempted, because your ring finger and your pinky, as you told me earlier,
yeah,
on, are resting on the body of the guitar. They never move at all. Have you ever tried involving them in what you're doing?
No, I've never tried at all. I've that's just how I learned. Just, yeah.
Now, so we had you start to learn the guitar. Then there was, I think, did you put it aside for a while, or certainly ease off on the guitar in at a certain point along the way?
Yeah, when I was about, like, I played the guitar for about a year, and then my brother, he started going to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and then I kind of got interested in it as well, and I wanted to go, and then I got really, really into that, and then about a year later, I started going to boxing as well, and then between the two of them, I just didn't have time to play the guitar anymore. I was going nearly every day of the week to boxing and Jiu-Jitsu, and then when lockdown hit, all that was shut down, and I just didn't have anything else to do, so I went back to the guitar, and I haven't really gone back to boxing or jiu-jitsu since.
Since that. And when you went back, that lockdown return to the guitar, did you jump a level in terms of what you could play and the songs that you were learning and the different styles? Because some of it is incredibly complex in terms of the rhythm and the picking.
Yeah, it was a lot harder than what I was playing when I was nine. And I just got a lot more into it, probably because I was older as well. And yeah.
You made the I think that was when you made the YouTube video, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was about, yeah, that was, I'd learned Police Dog Blues, and it took me about 6 or 7 weeks to learn it, and I put it up on YouTube then.
And would Police Dog Blues be, you know, one of the big standard pieces that anybody who wants to do finger picking blues has to kind of climb that mountain? Would it be considered that?
Yeah, it'd be considered a very hard song. not many people really play the song the way Blind Blake does. So kind of come up with their own version.
They kind of, in inverted commas, cheat. They have to simplify it in some
yeah,
ways.
Yeah, I suppose.
Had you a recording of Blind Blake, or how did you go about learning that?
Well, my dad taught me it, but I would listen to the song a lot. And we had like a slow down app where we'd slow down the song and we'd listen to it in slow motion so we could hear every note that he was playing.
And so you got it. Yeah. How did you go about learning Buck Dancer's Choice, which you're about to play for me now?
My dad taught me, and I learned to listen to the song quite a lot as well.
Whose song is this originally? It's an old traditional song.
Yeah, it's an old traditional song by Sam McGee, but it was made famous by John Fahey.
All right, well, let us hear. Then we're in Bradley version then of Buck Dancer's Choice. Buck Dancer's Choice. Still one guitar, still Muireann Bradley, still one thumb and just two fingers doing all that finger picking. Muireann will be performing as part of the Errigal Arts Festival, various dates in July. The shows, not surprisingly, are sold out, but you might find returns if you go to EAF, errigalartsfestival.ie for full details. And you can get Muireann's album, which is called I Kept These Old Blues. It's available on Spotify, and of course you can buy the CD as well. Tonight, the Women's Prize for Fiction in Britain was announced. There was a strong Irish field with nominations for Anne Enright and Claire Kilroy. The winner has just been announced. Fascinating choice. Vivi Ursugi Ganeshananathan for her book Brotherless Night, which is set in Sri Lanka during its civil war. Born in the United States of Sri Lankan parents, Sugi began writing Brotherless Night when she came across a story of a hunger strike during the Sri Lankan civil war. Sugi joins me on the line this evening. First of all, congratulations on winning the Women's Prize for Fiction for 2024. This is your second novel, Sugi, and I think you were still finishing your first book when you came across the material that ultimately grew into this winning novel for you, Brotherless Night.
Yes, that's right. Thank you so much.
Tell me a little bit about what it was that you saw that gripped your attention so much that it was going to be the grounds for your second novel.
Sure. Well, I think it was just a really complicated story that people told differently depending on their point of view. And the intersections of different points of view have always been fascinating to me. And I grew up hearing a lot of stories about that era. And how, in particular, civilians were affected by militarization of society at that time.
You know, and you pointed out immediately, and quite rightly, it's a very complicated story, as any civil conflict usually is. But for those who may have been not that familiar with the Sri Lankan civil war, could you give us the essence of it? I suppose the simplified version, which is kind of what you're fighting in the novel, to be fair, simplified versions of anything.
Thank you. It's true. That is what the novel is fighting. And also I have had some practice with this question. So the Sri Lankan Civil War, which was waged primarily between Sri Lankan government security forces dominated by the ethnic Sinhalese majority and militants from the ethnic Tamil minority. And there were multiple Tamil militant groups, of which the most prominent being the Tamil Tigers. And then there were also other players, other stakeholders. My novel includes a mention of Indian peacekeeping forces. Anyway, so the war began in more or less many people would date it to 1983, and then it ended in 2009. And during that period of time, some militant groups, and again, primarily the Tigers, were fighting for a separate homeland. And that was following successive decades of discrimination by successive Sri Lankan governments and kind of atrocities from all sides. And to kind of render that on the page was a real challenge.
Yeah, and immediately you have it there, you know, because I suppose in many ways any civil war is often boiled down to a very simple conflict between state and a militant body, to make it really simple. But what you're pointing out here, as you've said, from all sides, not from both sides, there were many, many, many sides involved. The opening sentence in the novel uses the word terrorist, and that word and the ideas around that word are hugely important in terms of what you're saying, I think, in Brotherless Night.
Yeah, that's right. I think that I was interested in kind of exploding that language, which in my nonfiction I generally don't use. I think that to talk about terrorism without talking also about state terror is, I think that we have to challenge that language and what it's doing, the ways that it ends conversations rather than keeps them going. And I come from a community where that kind of language was kind of slung around all the time. Sometimes, you know, people would meet me and it would be the first or second thing they would say. So to kind of the beginning of the novel is very intentionally a provocation in that way.
And you, of course, were, I presume, hearing many of the stories about the Sri Lankan Civil War growing up in the United States of America. What did that add, or what confusion, what extra layer does that add to how you go about telling the story?
That's a great question. Well, I think because it was harder to get information, I think I had a real hunger for that information because I was constantly aware that I was seeing really compelling points of view, but often only a partial view. So I think the distance in some ways made it so that I was really hungry to learn. And I think, I've lived in places with other people of Sri Lankan descent, other diaspora communities. But sometimes I also live in places where there are almost no Sri Lankans at all. And to be kind of hungry for that company, I think really kept me going.
I should explain to listeners, by the way, that obviously you're at an event celebrating your recent win of the Women's Prize for Fiction, Sugi, and that is the noise that we're hearing in the background. And thank you for taking time to talk to us when you should be celebrating as much as talking to people on the radio. So in terms of the fictional world that you created for the novel and your narrator, Sashi, give us a sense of that setup and what that allowed you to explore in Brotherless Night.
So Sashi is at the beginning of the novel. It's 2009. She's in New York and she is in her middle age and she's recalling her teenage years in northern Sri Lanka in the city of Jaffna when she was trying to become a doctor and she was an ordinary student trying to enter medical school. That was her dream. And her voice kind of pulls you through the story in that all of her dreams and ambitions, they transform in ways that she couldn't have imagined. So she is the person who she finds herself at the intersection of other people's politics. She practices medicine, but not in the space she would have expected. And a lot of the book, because of its focus on medicine, I think a lot of the book is about how we care for others. And I think I was really fascinated with the medical profession, been lucky to be adjacent to a lot of people who do that kind of work. And I have a lot of respect for it. And that is kind of one of the arrows driving through the story.
And I guess that idea that if you're a medical doctor in a conflict situation, you treat the patient, you don't treat the politics of the patient, you treat the patient, his or herself. You have had you mentioned non-fiction work and you did work as a journalist for a period of time. You conducted a lot of interviews for this book. Tell me a little bit about what kind of people or who were the people that you spoke to for Brotherless Night and why was it important to get that first-hand interview from those involved for you?
Sure. Well, I think, I was trying to capture the sound of a voice that came from a different time. I wanted her to sound right. I wanted it to feel the way it felt. So I spent a lot of time talking to people about logistics, but also trying to get at a sense of how they had felt then, how they felt about it now. I spoke primarily to people who had been civilians in that time and space. And I mean, now there are people like that all over the world, people who endured that war and in particular in Jaffna have migrated to all sorts of spaces. So to think about how that history gets carried forward, what it means, how it's remembered versus how it felt in the moment, that retrospection that Sashi brings to the story hopefully makes it possible to cover that span of time and reflect on it.
You know, when our own civil war in Ireland is often spoken about, the phrase that constantly arises is, brother against brother, family split down the middle. And it's often referred to in the Irish language as Cogan the Garrod, which literally means the war of friends, which is an interesting juxtaposition. I think in your novel, you look at this idea of, the Tamil Tigers of tomorrow are your friendly neighbours of today and the state, those who are committing atrocities with the state argument behind them, equally are your neighbours and friends of today. That adds a layer of confusion to it, but I guess that confusion and that complexity is absolutely essential.
Yeah, I think that's something that I was grateful to have the space of a novel because as you said, I had worked as a journalist and sometimes when I tried to sum up or to get at the complexity or the arguments or the shifts in point of view, the ways that people's politics change over time, I think to have the room of fiction, to have the length of a novel, to have 20 years to very slowly write it was really helpful.
But I guess, too, the other side of that is not to say that you took some kind of lazy route saying, oh, I don't have to get, you know, I don't have to triple check these facts. It's a work of fiction. I can make stuff up. I think you were very keen to have historical accuracy in there as well, in as much as one can ever achieve that.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, there were facts that had been in some ways like obscured or were harder to find. And I thought that if those things were accurate, it would enable people to focus also on the other aspects of the story, the characters, the very particular aesthetic of the prose, which engages with direct address. So the kind of interest in factual accuracy had to do with my relationship and to history and that war's relationship to history, which has a lot to do with kind of with censorship, really, and with certain narratives being underlined and elevated and other narratives not getting the same amount of attention. That was very much on my mind.
Have you visited Sri Lanka in recent times, and particularly since the publication of the novel?
Sure. Yeah, I was there earlier this year at the Ceylon Literary Festival, which was, great.
And what is the reaction to the novel there, where I suppose the history is much more present in some ways?
That's a great question. I think so. In Sri Lanka in recent times, things have been very socioeconomically challenging. I think, you know, for people to access books and pay for books, that can be a challenge. And it's also a country where there are many people who are reading in other national languages, who are reading in you know, Tamil and Sinhalese, people who are maybe not going to read a novel that's in English. So I want to acknowledge that the reaction there came from the English-speaking, English-reading folks, which is just a segment.
Yes.
And it was wonderful to be in conversation with some of those people who were very generous and attentive to the book and read it so carefully and then reflected back to me history that I didn't necessarily know, or experiences that were in conversation with what I had written. That was really exciting. And I appreciated the opportunity to do that.
All right. Well, listen, congratulations once again, Sugi, on your winning of the Women's Prize for Fiction, and enjoy the rest of your evening. I hope you can go off now and enjoy the event celebrating that win for us. That is Vivi Ganeshanathan. Her author name was Sugi, her personal name, as it were. She has won the Women's Prize for Fiction for her novel Brotherless Night, published by Zoom, I can't find that little piece of paper. Oh, there we have it. Published by Random House. And the winner of the inaugural Women's Prize for Nonfiction is Naomi Klein, and that is for her book Doppelganger. That is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Solly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.